This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli from Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next week, Steve Carell steps into the shoes and shoe phones of Maxwell Smart, Secret Agent 86, in a new movie version of Get Smart, the classic spy spoof TV series from the 60s. Here he is, confronting two agents from the evil organization known as Chaos.
Who are you?
My name is Nudnik Shpilkas. Who are you?
I am Siegfried.
I understand that you're the man to see if someone is interested in acquiring items of a nuclear nature.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Well, neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
It also makes sense that Steve Carell, our guest today, would fit comfortably into a role that began on TV, because he began there too. Steve Carell first drew attention as one of the correspondents on The Daily Show, before Jon Stewart got there. Carell also has had good luck inheriting TV roles established by other comics. His first big success came when he starred as the clueless boss in an Americanized version of the British sitcom The Office, a role he's still playing. At the same time, Carell became a movie star by playing the title character in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Since then, he's been in such films as Little Miss Sunshine and Evan Almighty, and lent his voice to such animated movies as Over the Hedge and Horton Hears a Who. Next week, he plays Control Secret Agent 86. The original Get Smart, created by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry, ran on TV from 1965 to 1970 and starred Don Adams as Maxwell Smart. Barbara Feldon played his beautiful partner, Agent 99, and Edward Platt played their boss, the Chief. Here's a taste of the TV version, after a Control agent, Jaime the Robot, has just gone haywire and tried to kill the Chief.
What happened, Chief?
He crashed through that door and said he was going to kill me.
But this is impossible, Chief. Jaime has been a loyal member of Control ever since we stole him from Chaos.
Max, Jaime is a robot, a machine, and machines can be dangerous.
Well, what are we going to do?
We'll have to destroy him.
Destroy him? You can't destroy Jaime. Jaime's my friend.
Max! This friend just broke through my office door, smashed my desk to pieces, and almost strangled me with his bare hands. How do you explain that?
I said he was my friend, not yours.
Don Adams based the voice of Maxwell Smart on that of actor William Powell. But Steve Carell, in the new movie, doesn't imitate William Powell or Don Adams. He's basically Steve Carell, comedy action hero. Yet another incarnation in a surprisingly varied showbiz career. Terry Gross spoke to Steve Carell last year.
Steve Carell, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about some of the parts that you've played in the past few years. In The Office, you are so great as Michael Scott, who is the manager in this small, Scranton-based paper, like office products, paper products office. How would you describe Michael?
Michael Scott is someone with an enormous emotional blind spot. He is someone who truly does not understand how others perceive him. And if he did gain any knowledge, his head would explode. He wouldn't be able to assimilate. He wouldn't be able to take in all of that information because certain people exist on a different level, and they are only able to exist because they're in a sense of denial about who they are or how other people view them. And I think that's who he is. But he's not a bad guy. I think he's he's a caring person. He wants what's best, but he doesn't always do the best things in order to achieve what he hopes to achieve.
And as an example of that, let's play a scene from The Office. This is one of my favorite episodes. This is the episode in which Michael outs Oscar, one of the employees, and he just doesn't get it. I mean, he just doesn't get what he's done. So early in, at like the very start of the episode, the human resources guy, Toby, is reprimanding Michael for outing Oscar. So we're going to hear that part, and then we'll hear it when Michael is directly addressing the camera, explaining himself.
No, that is the fun of this place. I call everybody faggy. Why would anyone find that offensive?
Okay, I think Oscar would just like if he's lame or something like that.
That's what faggy means.
No, not really.
Oh.
Apparently you called Oscar faggy.
Yeah.
For, like, the movie Shakespeare in Love more than an action movie.
It wasn't just an action movie. It was Die Hard.
All right, Michael, but Oscar's really gay.
Exactly.
I mean, for real.
Yeah, I know.
No, he's attracted to other men.
Okay, a little too far. Cross the line.
Okay, I am telling you, Oscar is an actual homosexual. Yeah, he told me this morning. And obviously he hopes he can count on your discretion.
I would have never called him that if I knew. You don't call retarded people retards. It's bad taste. You call your friends retards when they're acting retarded. And I consider Oscar a friend.
Steve Carell, when you got that script, did you think like, oh, this is so perfect?
It, you know what? That's one of my favorite lines that we call talking heads when we're actually addressing the camera. Because that, I think, sums up his character. He's not trying to hurt anyone. He just doesn't understand. And then the rest of that episode proceeds with him trying to be politically correct and trying to gain a relationship with this gay character on a different footing and to acknowledge and show how accepting he is. I felt like was an interesting, it was a well-written script too, because it pointed to, that subject without mocking it and having a character who truly he's not chauvinist. He's not racist. He's not homophobic. He just doesn't get it. And it's a completely separate issue. He doesn't get how to deal with people. It's not that he has any sort of axe to grind with any one group.
You know, a lot of people who have worked in offices feel like they've worked with somebody like Michael Scott, but you've never worked in offices. It's just, you know, you're an actor. So who do you draw on for the character? Are there teachers that you had or other people who you knew who were
primarily
as clueless?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It I think for me it stemmed mostly from various teachers that I had growing up, because many teachers that I've had, especially 5th, 6th, 7th grade, would be people who were trying to be as cool as the students or wanted the students to think that they were cool, but indeed they were not. And the harder they tried, the less cool they would appear to be. And that's basically what Michael is up against. He thinks people think he's cool. He thinks people like him and think he's funny and charming, but he's really none of those things. And incidentally, when you say everyone knows a Michael Scott, I guess the rule of thumb, Ricky Gervais told me this in regards to the character that he played, David Brent, in the BBC version of The Office, is that if you don't know a Michael Scott, then you are Michael Scott.
That's really great.
So better that you actually have a frame of reference for a Michael Scott.
Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with Steve Carell, who stars next week in the new Get Smart movie, a remake of the classic 1960s TV spy spoof. But first, let's hear a bit of the movie role that made Carell a star. Here's the scene where his friends discover that he is what the title of the movie says he is, the 40-year-old virgin.
Yo, answer this question. Are you a virgin? Are you a virgin?
Yeah, not since I was 10.
It all makes sense! You're a virgin!
I am... Shut up.
How does that happen?
He's a virgin. Oh, I knew it. That makes so much sense, man. He's a virgin.
You guys are hilarious.
All right. Come on, don't be mean.
Let me move on to 40-Year-Old Virgin, which you co-wrote. How did the idea get started for the film? Were you in on the very start of it?
Well, I pitched the idea to Judd.
Oh.
We worked together. He was one of the producers on Anchorman, in which I played one of Will Ferrell's less intelligent compadres. And Judd asked me at the end of shooting if I had any ideas for movie sort of things. And I had a meeting with him, and I just pitched this idea. It's something I'd been kicking around for a while. I didn't have a script in place. But my the seed of the idea, the notion was, and this is what I pitched to him, was a guy at a poker game with a bunch of other guys that he might not know very well. And everyone is – all the guys are regaling each other with these tales of conquest and women, and the conversation turns to him, and it's his time to step up and tell a story. And he has no frame of reference. He has no he can't speak this language that these other guys are speaking. And so he tries unsuccessfully to tell a tale of his own sexual conquest of a woman, and he just fails miserably. And that is when he is essentially outed, that he doesn't know what he's talking about and that he's a virgin. And Judd really liked the idea. And from there, he actually said, as soon as I pitched it to him, he looked at me and he said, I could call Universal right now and we could sell that idea this afternoon. And literally 3 days later, he was working with somebody from Universal. He casually mentioned the idea, and they bought it right then and there. They just said, "You go and write it, and we'll pay for that."
You know, at the very beginning of the film, there's a very funny scene where Seth Rogen is bragging about having spent part of the weekend watching A Woman and a Horse. and of course, you have nothing that could compare to that sexual feat. So you tell the story of how you spent the weekend making egg salad.
Right.
I guess, like, you know, since the premise of the movie when you came up with the idea was about listening to these sexual exploits and having, like, nothing to say that could measure up to that.
Yeah.
Had you been exposed to a lot of those kind of sexual bragging type of stories when you were in high school?
Oh, sure. When any group of young testosterone-riddled males get together, those stories are kind of inevitable, I think. And I always thought it would be funny if one person just could not keep up. And not only not keep up, but truly put his foot in it. In the movie, the character talks about feeling a woman's breasts, and he explains that they felt like a bag of sand. And clearly, this is not someone who has any experience. And to me, what was funny was not so much the story, but how the other characters were reacting to the story. It's like that there's a scene in which I get chest waxed, and I chose to actually get waxed for the movie because I thought it would be funny. And I thought not so much the fact that I'm being waxed is what's funny, at least to me, but the reaction that And a very natural reaction at that the other guys in the scene will have while I'm being waxed. Because that to me, you can't act. If a buddy of yours is having their chest hair waxed in front of you, you will react a certain way, and you'll capture something. And to me, that was the funniest part of the scene. These guys just cringing and laughing their heads off.
Well, let's hear the beginning of the chest waxing scene, and then we'll talk about how you reacted when your chest hair was really waxed. Here it comes.
So, ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
Oh, you! Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just your job,
huh? Just stop now.
No. That's okay. Let's do another.
That one little patch looks sexy, though.
Does it look good?
Yeah, it looks really good.
Ooh.
It looks man-tastic.
Ooh. I love how you're trying to be so nice. Oh, it's just your job. were you prepared?
That was the worst day.
Yeah,
ever.
How much did it really hurt, and were you prepared for it?
It hurt so much. And frankly, all of the women on the crew who had experienced waxing in their lives were... Each one of them came up to me individually, and they said things like, well, aren't you sure you don't want to trim your hair back a little bit, or would you like to take some Advil? just anything to kind of ease the pain. And of course, I thought, no, I want it to really hurt. It won't play unless it really hurts badly. And And the woman who was waxing my chest wasn't, in fact, an actual chest waxer or a professional waxer. She was an actress who listed that as one of her special abilities, which, as we all know, are usually lies. So she was just this side of proficient at it. And if you look closely on one take, you can see the blood.
Oh, I know.
Sort of bubbling to the surface. It really hurt. It hurt. And the hardest part was just continuing with it, because after that first rip, I knew that we had a lot more scene to go. And it didn't dawn on me. You know, I went in that morning, I thought, oh, this will be fun. And they'd set up six cameras because obviously we could only do one take of it. And then as she spread that hot wax on that first strip, I thought, this truly might have been a mistake. This might not end well for anybody. But I'm glad I did it.
What ground rules did you give yourself for, like, how much to curse or how much to scream?
Well, my idea behind it was to scream all sorts of different types of obscenities, from Kelly Clarkson to, you know, to the more generic swearing. But that underneath, as you pointed out, I apologize to her and say, well, I know you're just doing your job. So I figured he's a nice guy, but even nice people push to those limits can lash out, and in the face of that kind of pain, can drop that sort of veneer of niceness, which is interesting too, because I thought, you know, just character wise, that's what Judd and I wanted to do, that not to draw a picture of just a purely nice, innocent, wonderful, sweet guy. He had problems. He was just a guy. He wasn't like, there's a lot of gray area to a character like that. And rather than kind of paint him as a sort of a stereotype, we wanted him to be a bit more realistic, I guess.
So just getting back to that chest waxing scene one more time, did you end it prematurely because it hurt so much, or was the character supposed to walk out with his chest half done when he does?
The character was supposed to walk out. As soon as she got to the smiley face, or as Paul Rudd deemed it, a man-o-lantern, then at that point was when I was supposed to get up and leave. And believe me, I had plenty. I was done.
So what happened to your real chest hair that was left afterwards? Because, you know, I'm sure, in a state where you have some of your hair, you know, it's your half denuded of hair and half hairy.
Much to my wife's chagrin, it was left as is. Uh-huh. And she I wore a t-shirt for months after that. I could not expose my chest to anyone. It was really horrifying looking. And then when it grows back in, that is a mess. That is just ingrown hair festival. It is not anything I would ever recommend that someone do.
Now, at the end of 40-Year-Old Virgin, after you've made love for the first time, Catherine Keener, her character, turns to you and says, "How is it for you?" And you break out into song, singing "The Age of Aquarius," "When the Moon is in the Seventh House," etc. Who's that? Was that your idea?
Was my idea to do a big song and dance number at the end? As I was driving to one of our writing sessions, I heard some song. It wasn't Aquarius. Aquarius, the song itself, was Judd's idea, but I heard some song and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to, I mean, where else could this movie go at that point? I mean, what greater expression of joy and release, in a way, that everyone would break into a highly charged song and dance. It was extremely silly, but I thought it was fitting. I thought it was as happy an ending to a movie as there could be.
I love the ending.
You know what? I thought it was sweet. And some people were taken off guard by it or didn't understand it. I really thought of it as just the most pure expression of joy that this guy could show at that point.
And had you ever wanted to be in musicals?
Apart from being a sexy leading man, that's all I've ever wanted to do is be in musicals. I did musical comedies growing up. I did Summer Stock, and I was Judd in Oklahoma, and I played Duty in Grease, and I did a bunch of that sort of stuff.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. If you're just joining us, we're listening to an interview Terry conducted last year with Steve Carell, whose new movie, Get Smart, opens next week. Before Steve Carell got the starring role in NBC's The Office and became a movie star in such films as The 40-Year-Old Virgin, he was working on cable TV as one of the correspondents on Comedy Central's The Daily Show. He started in 1999, before Jon Stewart got there.
So how did you get on The Daily Show?
Stephen Colbert got me the job. I owe it all to him. We'd worked together at Second City, and then when they were looking for new correspondents, Stephen threw my name in the hat, and they called, and they essentially gave me an audition. But I owe him that job.
So what was your audition for The Daily Show?
Well, what they do, instead of a set audition, they send you out on a field piece. And my audition field piece was interviewing a man in Colorado who believed that Walt Disney had a subterranean lair built at Disneyland in which he would kidnap children and make them into mind control slaves. So that was my first Daily Show piece.
Was this a real guy who really believed that?
It was truly, and I almost didn't take the job because of this. Because essentially, The Daily Show back then was a bit meaner than it is today. It would go after extremely eccentric people who, for no fault of their own, believed we're just quirky. Some were
mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, yes. To put a fine point on it, they were. And to go out and to mock these people and to do a story about how crazy they are. This guy was mentally ill, and I felt terrible because really we weren't making any sort of point. We were just mocking the fact that he believed what he believed. And over the next several months, and you know, when John came on, the tone changed dramatically. And I almost didn't take the job. The only way, and I talked to Stephen about this too, and asked him how, because he's a very kind, gentle guy. And I said, how can you do it? You know, how can you rationalize this? Because it's just so mean, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's just these people can't fight back. And what I decided to do was to sort of assume the character of a boob, of an idiot. And the more ridiculous I was in the interviews, the dumber the questions that I asked, the more they would react to that. It sort of took the focus off the subject, and I became the idiot. So the audience was laughing at what an idiot and jerk I was as opposed to the people I was interviewing. And I felt kind of let them off the hook. But otherwise, it was a very hard thing for me to rationalize.
Did the Disney piece make it on the air?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that went on. They wasted nothing. Here's the other side of it, though. There were people that we interviewed who deserved it, who really deserved to be taken to task. You know, Stephen went somewhere down south and had this run-in with skinheads and the neo-Nazi groups, and that's a different thing. I mean, that's going after, you know, people of intolerance or people who deserve it, essentially. That I had no problem with at all, but it was that those innocent, quirky, frankly, unstable people, that was never fun. And it was always a trick to try to turn the joke on myself and away from them.
My guest is Steve Carell. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Acton, Massachusetts.
And tell me something about your neighborhood.
It was, we lived in a garrison, a brown garrison colonial, and my dad was an engineer. My mom was a psychiatric nurse. It was a pretty normal little town. I played with my friends in the neighborhood. We had something called Demolition Derby. We lived sort of at the bottom of a hill, and kids would build essentially soapbox kind of cars, and we would have races. But mostly it was to try to destroy each other's cars on the way down. So that's why we called it Demolition Derby. It was pretty normal. I wouldn't say bucolic Rockwell childhood, but it was a fairly normal upbringing with the youth hockey and the youth baseball and all of those things. I have three older brothers, and I was able to antagonize them as much as I could.
The hockey and the baseball and the demolition derby, and where did the theater come in? Where did acting come in?
That was just for fun. That was always a hobby for me. It's nothing I ever thought would end up being a career. And really through college, it was just something I did on the side and just something that I always enjoyed doing, but I never thought it was a viable career choice.
You thought your career was going to be law, right? You were about to apply to law school?
Yeah, that was the plan. And I think ultimately I was planning on doing that because I thought, my parents sent me to a private school the next town over. And I think they were not wealthy people by any means. And I think I felt obligated to pay them back somehow by making something of myself, because they had really worked very hard to send me to this great school. And so I sort of started thinking about law and that might be a good fit for me. And it came to filling out the applications, and the essay question asked why I wanted to be an attorney, and I just could not respond to that. I had no idea, other than that it sounded good, that it's something that I figured would make them happy. And I talked to them about it, and they were the ones who said I should try acting. They were the ones who said, this is something you've always liked to do. You should try it. You should at least give it a shot, because it's something you've always just had fun at, and that's what your life should be. It should just be doing something that you enjoy.
So when you decided that you would do that, that you would pursue acting, what did you see for yourself?
My goal as an actor was to just make a living. That was all. And by 1988 is the last year that I waited tables to supplement my income. And that's when I was able to just start acting exclusively and supporting myself. And that to me was the line that I was able to cross. And that was my line of success. That was it for me. If anything beyond that was icing on the cake.
Were you a good waiter when you were waiting on tables?
I was a terrible waiter. I tried very, very hard, but I didn't. I don't know. I don't think I was that good at it. I'd have nightmares about waiting tables, because I would have nightmares that the entrees would be done and I still haven't served the soup. And literally for years after I stopped waiting tables, I still had these nightmares. It's what waiters call being in the weeds. And when you have too many tables and not enough time to service everybody, and there's a great anxiety, because all I wanted to do was make people happy and please them. And when their food's cold or they haven't gotten their salad, or there's so many things that can go wrong, and I obsessed about it. I tried very hard, but I wasn't smooth. That didn't work for me.
So, you know, you didn't get like really famous until you were in your 40s. Do I have that right? I think it's in your 40s.
That's true. Yeah.
So, what's some of the upside and downside of having success come at what is a pretty late time for an actor?
Boy, upside or downside? Well, certainly I've waited a long time. Well, God, I don't even want to start with that, because that, you know what? If I say that I've waited for a long time, it's implying that I always thought this would happen, and I never thought this would happen in a million years. I am so shocked that any of this took place that I pinch myself all the time. And it seems ridiculous, frankly, that any of this actually happened. When it did, I think the fact that I'm older is helpful because I have it in perspective for the most part. I realize that as quickly as it came, it can all go away too, and I'm not assuming that it will continue. So I think I'm enjoying it more perhaps at this age than I would if I were younger, because I think being younger, I would assume that I was just at the beginning and this is just going to continue to roll and everything will just proceed accordingly. But I don't believe it. I'm sort of a guy who's always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so I think that's a defense mechanism to a certain extent.
What do you do on the opening night of one of your films?
We will go to the premiere, and I will watch and probably sweat my way through it because I hope that people will enjoy it. And then after all of the revelry, my wife and I will go get a cheeseburger and fries and a shake and go home.
Is the cheeseburger part of a ritual?
The cheeseburger is. We always, anytime we go to any of these, essentially anytime she has to put on a gown and I have to put on a tux, we will end up the night eating a cheeseburger at this place called In-N-Out in California.
In the evening gown and tux?
Yes.
And are you? It's just, you're the only people there dressed like that, probably.
Well, we drive through and we bring it home.
Oh, okay.
But we're certainly the only people in the drive through. But that's it. Because, and honestly, that is the part of the night I look forward to the most. Because I always feel extremely out of place at these things, and I think that might be sort of a cliche, but we truly do. I do not feel like I fit in to that. Walking the red carpet, all of that is just beyond me. I just don't feel a part of that world. I definitely feel like I'm an observer on nights like that. So we both are much more comfortable when we change into our sweatpants and are eating cheeseburgers at 2 a.m.
Steve Carell speaking to Terry Gross last year. His new film Get Smart comes out next week. Since its inception over a decade ago in Louisville, Kentucky, the rock band My Morning Jacket has developed a growing following that attracts a diverse audience. Its guitar-driven singer-songwriter sound has roots in one of the band's heroes, Neil Young. Its southern rock style connects it to such groups as Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers Band. And My Morning Jacket's lengthy instrumental jams are appealing to fans of the Grateful Dead and Fish. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's new fifth studio album, Evil Urges, goes a long way to establishing My Morning Jacket as more than just the sum of its influences.
One of the high points of Todd Haynes' wonderful Bob Dylan movie, I'm Not There, occurs during the middle of the film, when the Richard Gere Dylan ambles into a rustic town where a man is singing, Going to Acapulco. That singer is Jim James, the lead vocalist for My Morning Jacket. James is in whiteface makeup for the film, just as Dylan had applied whiteface for many dates on his 1975 Rolling Thunder review. And it's the sound of Rolling Thunder that rumbles through many of James's vocals on his band's new album, cracking the sonic landscape with its roiling power. Jim James has said that there's a theme of moral confusion running through this album, Evil Urges. I, however, hear a musical, verbal, and emotional clarity that's one of this collection's finest qualities. James is using his voice to sing out about glowing love, about being amazed by the world around him, and about emotions that compel him to entitle not one, but two songs, Touch Me, I'm Going to Scream, as in, if you don't touch me soon, I'm going to scream. And he sings about being thankful for someone who can see and appreciate his quote-unquote naked heart.
Really didn't think it's gonna make it. Really didn't think it's gonna make it this way. Put on my robot face. Had my emotions way far.
It's this sense of radiant open-heartedness that I find so invigorating, even thrilling, in the best songs on Evil Urges. A lot has been made of My Morning Jacket's admiration of Neil Young and Crazy Horse, the way that band has made thrashing music out of alienation and melancholy. But My Morning Jacket is making buoyant music. It possesses the grandeur of U2 without the stuffy self-consciousness and the pleasing sonic density of REM without the muzzy ambivalence. And then there are the guitars. That's Aluminum Park, one of a number of songs on which James lets loose thick, rapid chords and keening feedback, as well as making his voice sound like an extra instrument of howling reverberation. If you're on his wavelength, it's pretty sublime. And if you haven't been until now, Evil Urges is an album of conversion.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Evil Urges by My Morning Jacket. Three new documentaries opened this week. One is by Werner Herzog, one is by cult director Guy Maddin, and one is the story of an enduring love affair between writer Christopher Isherwood and a man 30 years his junior. Film critic David Edelstein reviews all three.
Few things are more satisfying in the middle of the Marvel Comics at the movie season than good documentaries, films that remind you life is so much more amazing than tank-throwing slabs of CGI green beef. Start with Werner Herzog's Encounters at the End of the World, shot on a trip made to the McMurdo Station in Antarctica. At first, the film is rambling. Herzog scans the settlement, which looks like an ugly mining town, and meets the sundry eccentrics who reside there. Who, he asks, are these scientists and adventurers drawn to the edge of the planet? And what are their dreams? But then his camera plunges below the ice to behold the strangest, blobbiest, spindliest creatures, so much more unfathomable than the Incredible Hulk. And gradually, uninsistently, an eerier theme creeps in. In his films, fictional and non, Herzog loves to dramatize, even over-dramatize, man's hubris toward nature. Explorers pit themselves against primal forces, which chew them up. But the people he meets in Antarctica turn out not to be the hubristic ones. They're the reporters, the realists, the ones who say the South Pole is not as solid as in our imaginations. He ends with underwater seal calls, high frequency, inorganic sounding, yet keening, like a message to extraterrestrials that this might, in fact, be the end of the world. Herzog grapples with the external world. Guy Maddin pulls the world into himself. His films, the latest being My Winnipeg, are montage collages. He weaves found footage into faux found footage to achieve an expressionistic and fetishistic intensity. It's like watching psychosexual messages piped in from the collective unconscious of moviegoers. Maddin's films are better in small doses before the overload of his imagery wears you down. But My Winnipeg keeps you entranced. It's grounded in a place, Maddin's Manitoban hometown, where the inner and outer worlds reflect off each other. The demolition of an old hockey arena is linked to the death of Maddin's father and the city's soul. He shoots an old woman playing his mother in stark close-up, superimposed over the landscape. She's emotionally withholding, yet repressive, with an aversion to all things sexual. The narrator, Maddin, pictures himself on a train, trying to leave Winnipeg, but never getting beyond the outskirts. He tells the true story of horses in the 1920s, driven from their barn by fire. They leaped into one of Winnipeg's four rivers and froze in place as the current met a sheet of ice. Then he shows footage of people strolling on that ice among the frozen horse heads, unaware of the symbolism, while Maddin palpably sides with the animals, their faces contorted in agony. Like them, he's not going anywhere. A more optimistic, transcendent note is sounded by Guido Santi and Tina Mascara's Chris and Don. Chris is Christopher Isherwood, the gay English aristocrat famous for Berlin Stories, which became the basis of Cabaret. Don is Don Bacardi, 30 years younger, whom Isherwood met on a Santa Monica beach. Here's a bit of his diary read by Michael York, then the voice of Bacardi today.
That spring, I realized that I had fallen deeply in love with a boy whom I had known for only a short while, Don Bacardi. The 30-year difference in our ages shocked some of those who knew us. I myself didn't feel guilty about this, but I did feel awed by the emotional intensity of our relationship right from the beginning. The strange sense of a fated mutual discovery.
This is more or less the area of the beach where I met Chris. And that would have been when I was probably 16. He was so friendly. He had such a charming smile and sparkling eyes. Eyes that had such energy. Eyes that ate you up.
It might be pathetic. Rich old guy prowls the beach, finds movie star-obsessed stud muffin who goes along for the ride. But Chris and Don tells one of the most tender yet unsentimental love stories I've ever seen. Isherwood needed to find love and commitment outside his class. He pressed Bacardi to pursue his talent for drawing, and Don became a marvelous portraitist. They had periods of estrangement, took lovers, pushed the limits of domesticity. But in the end, Bacardi was by Isherwood's deathbed, drawing him compulsively, drawing his body in the hours after death. The sequence, like the movie, is shockingly open and heartfelt. Bacardi is feverishly capturing the surface details in an attempt to go beyond them, as if he's searching for the core of his lover's being. Realistic as it is, Chris and Don is a profound documentary of the human spirit.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Guy Madden's My Winnipeg is available on cable TV through IFC On Demand.